This was in the 1960s in northern BC, a time, I say to people, when there were two things you didn't want to be. One was a communist, and as a young kid, I didn't know very much about them other than that they were in submarines and they wore green clothes. And then the other was an Indian. And that was all around me, the really apartheid kind of way that Northern British Columbia was scheduled in those days. I remember the Indian entrances at the bar, even when I was like 5, 6 years old. I couldn't understand why there would be two entrances, one for Indians and one for everybody else. And I know that when I would go to the restaurants with my family, other people who come in later would get served if they were non-Aboriginal before we would get served. And sometimes you just pick up that essence that you really don't matter as much as everybody else.
Cindy Blackstock learned at a very young age that Canada isn't always fair or just in its treatment of Aboriginal people. And she's been crusading for fairness and justice ever since. Cindy is a child welfare worker who's taken it as her mission to ensure First Nations children in care get the same treatment as other children. She's taking that message across Canada and around the world, and people are taking notice, including the Canadian government, a government that sees her as a threat, a government that's been spying on her. Really? Is a child welfare advocate a domestic terrorist? Is a person fighting for fairness for First Nations children an enemy of the state?
I am actually, I say to many Canadians, I am standing up for the very values of this country. You know the line in O Canada says, O Canada, we stand on guard for thee? I take that seriously. I think every person in this country deserves to be treated with respect, fairness, equity, and justice, and particularly children. And I think it's not right for us as Canadians to sit at the sidelines if we see our government wandering astray from those values.
I'm Don Kelly, and this is Trailbreakers. We're looking at the people who are making waves, making noise, and driving change in Indian country. And today, we're going to Ottawa to find out about Cindy Blackstock, a child welfare advocate who's fighting for a better world for First Nations children and taking on the government to do it.
We have to move right now. And we need to, as adults, at least show these children and young people that we love them enough to fight for them.
It's a chilly Thursday morning in Ottawa. People are bustling about at the downtown convention center, name tags on lanyards around their necks, darting in and out of meeting rooms. It's the Assembly of First Nations December meeting, and strategy sessions are taking place throughout the center. Signs out front of the rooms reveal topics like lands and resources and education. About 50 people are gathered in a gray-walled, windowless room located just off the main hall. Three panelists are sitting at a table at the front of the room. The sign out front simply says, children.
I'm looking at Wanda going, I've been in your seat before having to talk after Cindy.
You're Gitsan, as I understand. Tell me just a little bit about the community where you grew up and what it was like growing up there.
Well, I really grew up in the bush, and I call my childhood unincorporated because for the longest time, we never lived in a place with a mayor. My father was with the Forest Service in the days before there was radar. So we would literally live in these very out-of-the-way places along the side of the highway.
Cindy Blackstock is the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada. Cindy is a powerful presence, but she's not an imposing woman. She's slight with a fair complexion and soft features, dark brown hair with light blonde streaks, and a natural smile and a gleam in her eyes that conveys the predisposition of an innate optimist. So what was it that got you into that field? Was there a trigger where you said, this is the kind of work that I want to do? It's not easy work. What was it that made you want to get into that?
You know, a lot of people have asked me, is there a moment when that happened? But, you know, I think an elder that I met in BC really said it the best. He said, you were born to do this. There were so many times in my life when I would have, acting on my own devices, just made different choices. And yet somehow I was always pulled in this direction. So when I was going into university, I thought the arts or social sciences were for people who did not succeed in the sciences. You know, I was that kind of kid, right? I was there with my beakers and Bunsen burners and all the rest of it. But I ended up working in a group home to raise money to go to school. And it was there that I just really started to feel a real sense of what was to come for me and my future. And I saw a lot of Aboriginal children, and I'll never forget these two girls who came from an isolated community. And one of the first things we did is we sent them in to have a shower. And they didn't come out for a while, so I went in and I saw them, and of course they didn't know how a shower worked. And I thought, they removed them from their community to this? This is better than where they came from, really? You know, the whole culture shock. They spoke their own traditional language, but instead of that being viewed as a strength in those days, many viewed that as, how are they going to make it in the modern world? And I just, that kind of got me set on this trail.
It was that on-the-ground, in-the-field experience with children in care that opened Cindy's eyes to the unfair and insensitive treatment towards First Nations children and families. The system, the state, was penalizing the kids and their parents for situations they didn't create.
Now, did you always know you're going to focus on Aboriginal children? Was there something specific there in your background as an Aboriginal person, or did that just happen as your career unfolded?
Well, actually, for the first 8 or 9 years, I did child welfare for everybody in the provincial system. But through that, you just start to see the overrepresentation of First Nations children in care. And after a while, you start to see the pattern, that it's for reasons that the parents can't control on their own, and yet child welfare always holds everybody accountable for everything, even those things that they can't control. And that didn't seem to be fair, especially because child welfare makes such a lousy parent. You know, a lot of the general public think that we remove these kids from these terrible situations and we put them in good situations. Well, that's not true. The state is a terrible parent. You have social workers that are so overworked that they don't know the child's favorite color. They don't know when their birthday is. They don't know the names of all their brothers and sisters or their medical plans. All you have is a file. And that's despite the very best efforts. It's not to kind of lay blame at the social workers, just that the system is overloaded. We are removing children, and we're not asking the important question of whether we have something better to provide them.
The result is a massive overrepresentation of First Nations children in care. Right now, there are more First Nations children in state care than there was at the height of the residential schools era. You're listening to Trailbreakers on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius 159. We're looking at the people who are on the cutting edge of Aboriginal culture. Today, we're talking about Cindy Blackstock, who's fighting for a better life for First Nations children. Cindy is a vocal critic of the government and the way it undertakes child welfare, and she's pushing for change. And while the government is pushing back, you won't find a lot of Aboriginal people critical of Cindy's work. Preston Gunu is a Nishkaman who has been a child welfare advocate for more than a decade, working with children on and off reserve.
What I see not happening is the legal advocates from across this country rallying up and supporting the direction that Cindy's bringing us. So there's a definite need for more support for that angle. There's also, again, like I said, a need for support in our own backyard, on the ground. What's going to change today? What can we do today to tackle these issues and start tackling these issues? Because if we keep relying on one person or rely on more reports that state the obvious, we'll be in the same situation in the next 10, 15 years.
Cindy sees a continuum in the government's approach to First Nations child welfare, one that runs from the residential schools through the 60s scoop, where Aboriginal children were purposely adopted out and placed with non-Aboriginal families, to today's system. Cindy, though, is unique from a lot of her peers in that she was spared the pain and post-traumatic stress of the residential schools, an experience that scarred so many of her generation.
Literally, we lived in Lower Post for part of that time, one of the most abusive residential schools just down the street. And I don't know what kept me from out of that school, but I'm just thankful that I never was scooped up and brought into there. And all around me in the community, I remember going to the reserve. We used to go to the reserve. It used to be like going to a big town, right? So, you know, whoa, we're on the reserve. It's got a candy store. And I remember then seeing a lot of the multi-generational effects of it, the drinking, the despair. And it just seemed like when you cross the highway from onto the reserve, things were different. What wasn't clear to me is why, because there's lots of silence around. no one really was talking about the why, other than the stereotypes you get from the non-Aboriginal community, which was that, you know, Indians is what they would call us. Indians were stupid. Indians never went on to university. Indians were lazy. And that's why all these things were happening. And sometimes you felt like maybe they're right. Like when I looked around in my community, these small little places that I lived, I don't remember another Aboriginal person who ever went to high school. And no one could really tell me what the inside of these high schools looked like because no one had ever gone there. You got to remember, this: I was born in 1964, so that was just a few years after that ban was lifted and where Aboriginal people could actually go into these public schools. And I remember very often being the only kid in these schools who was Aboriginal in my class. And you wonder, where is everybody else? Well, everybody else was in residential school.
What did keep you out of residential schools?
Well, I think that two factors in my favor. One is we were out in the middle of nowhere, so there was a lot of Indian agents passing by. So in some ways, that was good. The other is we moved around a lot. I mean, I think we moved 15, 16 times before I was, you know, an older teenager, just moving around all these different little places. We get transferred every spring with the fire seasons. And I think that played in our favor. And we had a dog, a big dog that was part wolf. He was half wolf. And I have to think that anybody came onto our property, that would have been the first sight that they would have had of Caleb, and that would have been the end of them.
If Cindy was spared the residential schools experience, she's no stranger to it. She's seen the effects firsthand, not only on her friends and others who did time in the schools, but as well as the intergenerational effects on children that were raised or lost by survivors. These survivors of survivors are too often simply abandoned by the system, and the cycle continues.
I remember sitting with not just one, but several young people who were aging out of the child welfare system. These were kids who were turning 18. And what we had done in child welfare is when they become a permanent ward, we close their family service file. And what that means is we stop working with the family. We stop doing anything to really engage that child with their family. And I don't know why we do that. I think that's a stupid thing because the family is continuing to be there. And let's face it, every family has got a constellation of what I call very eccentric or sometimes crazy people, right? But there's good people in there too. And instead of nurturing those relationships, we cut off that file. And the child then is at 18, and we're sending them out to what? You know, they're thinking, who's going to be there when I need to have some help getting some place to live? Or who's going to be there when I have my first baby? And I remember sitting and going through these files and thinking, this is the child's life. And it was very thin. They would be asking me, where did I live when I was 4 years old? Or when did I win any awards in school? Or when did I take my first step? And we couldn't tell them any of that. You know, there's a lot of social workers out there who say, well, the paperwork is too much. But I have always felt that we have an absolute responsibility to write these children's stories.
Chelsea Edwards is a keeper of those stories. Chelsea is 16, a young girl with long, dark hair. She's continuing the dream of her cousin, Shannon Koustashian, a young girl who fought for a school in her Cree community of Attawapiskat in northern Ontario. Shannon organized campaigns, took her fight online and to Ottawa, where she confronted the Minister of Indian Affairs. Shannon was just a teenager when she was killed in a car accident. Now, Chelsea and Cindy are keeping Shannon's dream alive.
My name is Chelsea Edwards. I am from Attawapiskat First Nation. I am 16 years old, and I am the youth spokesperson for Shannon's Dream. What this campaign does is it calls on the federal government to close the funding gaps of unreserved schools for First Nations. I never went to a comfy school. I never got that experience as I was growing up. When I realized that this wasn't a real school, Shannon actually started one of the biggest letter-writing campaigns in Canada. So I decided to hop on and team up with her. But after her passing, I decided to do something in her honor as a huge thank you to her.
Chelsea and Cindy are going to keep fighting for fairness for First Nations children. But Cindy knows firsthand that you can pay a price for speaking out.
Well, we set this up, a number of us, back in the late 1990s. And it was set up really in an interesting way, because we had been talking to our colleagues. We understood that the underfunding was undermining the success of families all over the country. But we also understood something else, that when individual communities would raise these issues with the federal government, you'd end up with an auditor at your doorstep, something like Attawapiskat is experiencing right now. This tactic has been going on for years. Instead of addressing the problem, they actually, your funding grant gets refused. The problem with that is it has a direct impact on the children themselves. The funding is a first domino issue. If that falls, then it makes the implementation of good ideas possible. But if you're talking about best practices and you still got people's providing services at far less than what non-Aboriginal folks are getting, then that's just a recipe for disaster. So the Caring Society was set up to actually take the hits, to be able to address this inequity, and to be willing to die as an organization if necessary. We were structured with the mandate to go to the wall on this. And that may be, and it turned out to be true, that the federal government would no longer fund the organization.
It's a bit shocking to realize that the Canadian government will actively try to muzzle and punish someone who's pushing for a better life and a fair chance for children. But that's exactly what happened. And that fight became explicit when Cindy and the Assembly of First Nations decided to launch a human rights complaint against Canada for its underfunding of First Nations child and family services. The Canadian Human Rights Commission agreed to hear the complaint.
You know, we had spent 10 years around the table with Canada before that, not only talking about the problem and its terrible impacts on children. Canada has a document where they call the impacts dire on the children. But instead of saying, well, we need to fix it, they say, well, we're worried about being sued when these kids grow up. And having solutions developed by some of the best economists and social workers in the country, They walked away from both of those solutions at a time when it would only cost 0.5% of the surplus budget to do the right thing. We were all mindful around that table that a child had grown up during that time. Those 10 years that we had sat there, there were children out there who were being treated and given less by the government because of who they were. So were we going to sit around that table for another 10 years with more bureaucrats who are going to tell us that they're trying their best and that they'll give us another little drop in a bucket that won't come close to equality? Or were we going to do the courageous and right thing, and that is force them to do what they should be morally doing? And that's why we filed that complaint.
What did you think as you were going through the complaint of the government's rationale, if rationale is the word, the arguments that they were putting forward? What were you thinking?
Well, you know, I think most Canadians would expect them. If you're coming out with an allegation that they're racially discriminating against First Nations children, the government of Canada is doing that. Most Canadians would expect, if that's not happening, then they should just argue this on the facts. Let's just argue it on the facts. It's such a serious allegation. Clearly, if Canada is in the right, then they should put their facts forward. But of course, they're in the wrong. The Auditor General even says that. And their own documents say that. So instead of, you know, doing the right and moral thing, which is fixing the problem for children, they engage in these trying to get off a hearing in the merits with legal technicalities. Legal loopholes that would immunize them from any accountability to children for discrimination. And I think that is totally immoral and anti-Canadian.
You're listening to Trailbreakers on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius 159. We're looking at the people who are finding new ways forward for Aboriginal people. Today, we're talking about Cindy Blackstock, who's fighting for a better life for First Nations children. Cindy, in her own words, had to take a hit and watch her organization fall for the kids. When the state brought down its heavy axe and cut off her funding, she didn't know how she was going to make ends meet.
You know, I was sitting there thinking, how am I going to pay my staff? How am I going to pay the rent? And a bulky envelope arrived in the mail. And it shook, like with kind of like bells ringing. And I opened it up, and it said, "Dear Cindy, here's some MUNY for the kids. Love, Ella." And inside was $1.67. And I just knew we were going to be okay. And we are now in a place where we're sustainable for at least another 10 years without any government funding. And it's not at a big level. We have a rundown office that overlooks Scotty's Bong Shop and High Times around the corner. But we have four staff. But you know what? We have the freedom to act on values and to be and to have the integrity to do the right thing for kids, no matter what Canada throws at us. And that's worth more to me than some plush office doing government contracts that are often bad ideas dreamt up by people who have never been out to the communities.
And Cindy's taken her message to the international community. She and Chelsea are off to the United Nations to speak at the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child to tell the truth about how Canada treats First Nations children.
We're asking the United Nations to put pressure onto our federal government. Education's the most basic right, and yet Canada doesn't deliver on their promises. As for Cindy, she encouraged me to go on with this campaign. She once gave me this message: you should stand up for what you believe in, even if it means that you're standing alone, and keep speaking even though no one is listening, because eventually you'll get heard.
Even though the government's doing its best to keep her down and keep her quiet, Cindy's fired by that drive to change the reality she's seen firsthand. It's a drive that comes from someone who started working in the trenches.
The hardest job I ever had was doing line child protection work. I did it for over a decade. And for anyone who thinks it's an easy job, it simply isn't. There's no days for like Teacher's Day where you get an apple or anything like that. You're going into these very difficult situations. That by far was the hardest thing. What I did is in my career is I started to see these patterns where it was these things that parents couldn't control. So I decided I was going to do child protection, but this time against stupid policies that don't work and advocating for the proper services for people.
And Cindy admits that she's not the fearless advocate she's sometimes painted as. Plain and simple, sure, she gets scared.
The poverty, the poor housing, the fact that services aren't structured in a way that respond to people's needs, the inequitable services are sourced amongst the most powerful Canadians, those that staff our Houses of Parliament, our legislatures, and some of our most powerful businesses. And they can be very, how can I say it? Scary, I guess, in terms of what they will do to silence people.
The government wasn't just trying to silence her. As a result of the human rights complaint, Cindy found out that the government was actually spying on her.
This next story will allow conspiracy theorists to sleep easy tonight. Big Brother is watching. Blackstock is known around the world.
It's quite a large file, full of surveillance records, emails, personal information, and critical briefing notes gathered by bureaucrats at Aboriginal Affairs.
Well, I'm not generally paranoid, but I'm too busy to be paranoid. But back in December 2009, I was actually here at an AGA with the chiefs, and we get up there, and it's clear that they're uncomfortable, the INAC staffers. And as I'm walking through the door, there's this gentleman there, and he says, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Cindy Blackstock." And he said, "Well, we'll meet with you at another time." I said, "Pardon me?" He said, "Well, you got the tribunal, and you have all these other concerns about us. We're going to meet with you at another time." I said, "I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here as a technical assistant." And one of the grand chiefs steps up and says, "Yeah, she's here not to talk about those other issues. She's here to support us as a technician." And this INAC staffer said, "Well, grand chief, do you want to meet with us or not?" And the grand chief said, "Do you mean to say, if this lady's in the room, you are unwilling to meet with us to discuss child welfare funding in Ontario?" And he said, the INAC staffer said, "That's exactly what I mean." So I voluntarily stepped out of the meeting, because this is about children, and I sit on a couch. And that's when I look up across the coffee table, and I see this humongous guy there, over 6 feet, got to be like 250, 275, security guard guarding me. Now I'm wondering, what is it that provokes the government of Canada to call a security guard on someone who's size 6, doesn't have a criminal record, doesn't even have a parking ticket, and is there to talk about kids? So I filed a couple of things. I filed an access to information request, and I filed a privacy request. It took a year and a half, but I got a whole whack of documents. And it's been clear that they've been monitoring very closely what I've been doing. And one thing that worried me quite a bit is that I have made no inquiries about my Indian status since 2003. The information request I asked for was between 2007 and 2009, and my registry is pulled at least twice during that time. And of course, that has information, all my personal information, that of my brother, my sister, my mother, my father, my grandparents who have passed over 50 years ago. Like, what are they doing with that? I, to this day, have gotten no correspondence from them. So I don't know what they're going to do, but I felt a responsibility to go public with it because I thought, if this, you know, there's all this stuff around monitoring First Nations people, but if this is the bar where you have somebody who doesn't have a criminal record, no parking tickets, child advocate, and they're spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to follow me around versus doing the right thing for kids, then what are they doing for other Canadians? It's very concerning in what's supposed to be a democracy. I decided a long time ago that it's much easier to live with courage than it is to live with fear. And I have been brought up by my mother, who has instilled the most powerful values in me. And she said, you know, if you live by values, you have nothing to be afraid of. And so when Canada, through the Canadian Human Rights case, cut all of our funding, or they've been apparently been monitoring what I've been doing from the documents that I've been getting, those things are unsettling, but they don't touch to the core of what I want. I'm not interested in money. I'm not interested in power. I'm interested in living in a country where First Nations children and their families feel respected, feel proud of who they are, get equitable treatment, and are able to live peacefully and respectfully with other Canadians. That's what I want. And I'm prepared to put up with whatever comes my way in order to get there.
Tell me about your mother.
Oh, my mom is my hero. I love my mom. You know, one of the things... just recently with this monitoring situation, I went home to see her, right? And of course, some of the documents they pulled have all my mom's detailed information as well. So I had to kind of let her in on the fact that Canada seems to be taking quite an interest. And normally when I go to home, we have one of those like 70s houses with the veranda. Mom was outside welcoming her kid back, but she wasn't there. So I lug my luggage up to the front door, and all of a sudden the door opens a crack. And my mom sticks her head out, and she's wearing dark glasses and a hat. And she looks to the left, and she looks to the right, and she doesn't see anybody there, so she pulls me in. And she says, you know, she starts laughing, and she says, well, look at all the trouble you got into. And I said, well, it's all your fault. And I remember this family in a small town we lived in when I was 4 years old. I finally got a bike. I still remember it was turquoise, and it had, you know, the old banana bars there with the tassels. I was amazed, right? This was the smartest thing on the block. And mom allowed the kids who were considered to be the worst kids, the worst family on the block, you know, the ones that everybody wants to stay away from, to look after our house while we went on vacation. The reason that I was so upset about that is that they had stolen my bike. I couldn't believe it, that after stealing my bike, my mother would invite these kids to look after our house while we're on vacation. So there I am, squirreling away all my stuffed animals, you know, like, I mean, and I was just mad the entire vacation. I thought for sure we'd come back and all of my other stuff would be gone too. And we came back and the house was immaculate. And I was shocked. And I remember my mom saying, she said, you know, people will do what you expect of them. If you believe in people, they will do the right thing. And that really set a great example for me. And I always, but that's why I think up until today, no matter what the history's been between non-Aboriginal people and First Nations people, I absolutely believe in non-Aboriginal people to do the right thing.
People will do what you expect of them. It's a teaching Cindy's taken to heart, a conviction that keeps her pressing forward in the belief that even if the Canadian government isn't interested in protecting First Nations children, Canadian people are.
I want to raise awareness amongst the non-Aboriginal people about the unfairness. And then I want to engage those people in actually creating a social movement that makes the type of racial discrimination we've seen by the Government of Canada against First Nations children politically and socially unviable.
I have to ask, Cindy, are you an enemy of the state?
No, I am actually, I say to many Canadians, our government is to serve us as citizens. And we expect that they give every opportunity for kids. So if Canada doesn't believe that every child should be given an equitable and fair opportunity to grow up and be proud of who they are, then I guess I would be an enemy of the state. But I'm not an enemy of Canadians. Canadians agree with me.
It's been said that the measure of a society is in how it treats its weakest members. Cindy Blackstock is going to keep fighting for First Nations children, too often the most vulnerable of the most vulnerable. She'll stand up against the state, the spies, and the critics because for her, it's not just a fight for First Nations children. It's a fight for the very values that make us Canadian, a commitment to fairness, justice, and sharing. Cindy believes in the battle, and she believes that by reaching out to all Canadians, that battle can and will be won. You've been listening to Trailbreakers on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius 159. This episode was produced by Angela Sterrett. Be sure to check out our TV partners on this project, The Eighth Fire, on CBC Television tonight at 9. You can hear more episodes and see special Trailbreaker features at cbc.ca/trailbreakers. And we'd love to hear from you. Our email is trailbreakers@cbc.ca. The senior producer for Trailbreakers is Doug Holmes. I'm your host, Don Kelly, and you can hear another episode at this time next week. Miigwech. Thank you.